them unclear how much time they have.
It's listed in.
The total is about a 30-minute block.
Yeah.
That's total presentation and units.
Okay, so, so you should have 20 minutes. Okay, we're ready. So it's a pleasure to have John Leike here. Dr. Leike and I have been colleagues and friends for 40-some years now. He started out after his PhD at Albert Einstein in Pharmacology. He was a postdoctoral fellow. And we've worked together as collaborators and friends ever since. His career in science has been paralleled by an independent career in ethics. Beginning with Jewish ethics, Jewish interpretation of biological dilemmas, but more recently spread out into all of the problems of life science, or the issues of life science, I should say, not the problem of life science. He runs a one-hour, one-point course downtown.
Two credits.
It's expanded. Two credits course downtown on bioethics. It has a wonderful group of students each year who take that as an elective, and publishes a journal on bioethics through that course. I think you will find what he has to say instructive and interesting, and certainly timely, because as we learn more and more about how we work, it leads us to all kinds of real and pseudo ethical problems, and some of them appear to be huge and suddenly go away, and others creep up on us and are suddenly huge and don't go away. So, John?
Thank you very much. So, the title of my talk is The Out and Ethics of Genetic Editing. I have to tell this is a work in progress, because all this stuff is so new. It's really come up in the last few years that very little has been written about this in terms of the ethical side. A lot has been written about the science side. Now, you look at this picture, and you have to ask yourself, what is the significance of this picture? Well, why is it like this? And that maybe at the end of the talk, you'll tell me why this is an important picture. Okay? So what I'm going to do today is tell you the newest technology in genetic editing. Then I'll tell you potential medical applications of this technology, bioethical challenges, which you are going to tell me what they are, and then maybe together we'll try to resolve these challenges. So keep in mind, think ethically and resolution. Just for those of you who are not biologists, let's go through some basic elements. You have the cell. Cell has chromosomes. Now, the two areas, the two organelles in the cell that has the DNA. You have, of course, most of it in the nucleus. You all know that. And some of the mitochondria is a very small percentage. But most of it is in chromosomes. And they're really packed together. If you unwind it, it comes out to about, 2 meters of DNA per cell. That's a lot of DNA if you would just stretch it out. And it's compact by proteins. And you stretch it out, you get to the point where you can have the individual classical double helix that we all know about. And it says here there are 3 billion DNA subunits, the base pairs. That's pretty true. They're not 30,000 genes. Every time we do it, it gets lower and lower. We're now probably between 20 and 25,000 genes, and probably closer to 20,000 genes according to the last estimate, which is pretty amazing because we're a very complex organism. We don't have a lot of genes. Okay, next. Well, it's just the way of the chromosomes and the base pairs. Okay, now there are 4 basic steps to gene editing. It sounds very complicated, but I'm kind of really hone it down to very easy things. One, targeting where you want to edit the base pairs. Okay? That's the first step. The second is, once you've tagged the right location, how do you remove what you want to eliminate? Whether it's, is it one base pair? Is it like a point mutation? Or is it a whole region, a repeat? Right? Then replacing the base pair, let's say you have a genetic mutation, Tay-Sachs. Well, one gene, right, has a mutation, could be one base pair, one nucleoside, and one nucleotide, and you want to just replace that to make it normal. Can you do that? And then you have to repair that site. That, these are really the four basic elements to gene editing. And there are a lot of ways of doing this. And we have internet here, right? Internet. Okay. So we'll go through each of these steps. You have the single finger nucleases. I'm just giving you the terms. I'll tell you a little bit about them in more detail. You have the second is TALEN, the BUD genome editing system, which is very new, and the CRISPR genome editing system, which people are very excited about. This, and I'll go into more detail. Let me see if I can show you this video, because YouTube is very important sometimes. Okay, let's see if we can get this. We don't have sound, do we? Do we have sound? Okay. Do we have sound on this computer? Okay. Oh, good. I know.
Yeah.
I agree. Okay.
Our method of the year for 2011 is genome editing of engineered nucleases.
Okay. Come on.
This is a technology that lets researchers pick just about any spot in the genome in many species and put in exactly the change that they want. It's a powerful way to control the function of genes. In the clinic, researchers are looking into using gene editing nucleases as therapies. For example, blood cells are taken for patients with HIV and then mixed with nucleases that are designed to snip out the protein in blood cells that lets the virus in. It's too early to know if that's going to help patients, but it is fair to say that scientists are really excited about those possibilities. Gene editing nucleases have two parts. One part binds the DNA, and researchers can design that to recognize just about any sequence they want. The other part, the nuclease, works like scissors. That cuts the DNA and makes what's known as a double-strand break. Once the DNA is cut, the cell has to repair it. That repair process either deletes the gene where you cut it, or if you put in new DNA with the sequence you want, then that new DNA is incorporated into the genome. Right now, there are two types of engineered nucleases. One type is called zinc finger nucleases, and the other type is called...
That's basically what I'm showing you. Let's stop here.
Activator-like effector.
Okay, let's go back to PowerPoint. All right. Okay, so that's basically what I just told you. Told by a scientist who's involved in this. Okay? Now, the major difference in all these four types is one difference, and that is how it recognizes the DNA. The first three recognize about protein-DNA interaction. So you target, you have to construct the protein in such a way that it reacts specifically to the site that you want. The fourth one, the CRISPR, is a different system. It uses an RNA guide, which is complementary to the DNA, and using these guides, you direct, by complementary pairing, you direct to the site of the DNA. So that's the major difference. Now, how do they differ from classical gene therapy? Does anybody know about classical gene therapy? What is gene therapy? We've been doing this for about 30 years almost. How is that done classically?
With different vectors like viruses.
Right. You have a virus, which you have the right gene that you want to insert. And what is the main problem of that therapy?
It's not very successful.
Well, it can be successful, but what's the main problem? Yeah?
You may not always enter the location you want.
It's a random location, exactly. How do you direct it to go to the right place? And there are other problems in terms of reaction to the virus, new reaction, et cetera, like that. Okay? But that's where it's been different. But keep in mind that gene therapy has been going on since the late 80s. Okay. And I just want to go through very briefly. The zinc finger nucleases has the scissors, and they recognize specific areas of DNA. It's not as broad. You cannot direct these zinc finger proteins to any site that you want. You have to have specific chemical characteristics of the DNA to direct that. But the same pattern, in a sense, works all the way through. The TALEN comes from the French word CLA, means transcription activator like effector nucleases. Who can ever remember that? Not me. But it's a very cute, but the CLA, I thought it was very clever. Now, you should know something. In science, it's very, very important to have the right name. Sam and I were telling this years ago. Sam had this brilliant idea. He asked the question, he says, how is it that a white blood cell can digest through a capillary, through a matrix, to get to the cell it wants? It usually is called enzymes or proteases, which really require digest away the proteins. The problem is that all of your whole body, you're full of these antiproteases. These antiproteases stop the body from dissolving itself. So if the white cell really wants to crawl through, how does it do it? Well, you have all these antiproteases. So we discovered this amazing process where as cells adhere to a surface, they form zones of tight adhesion. They form this really compact zone. They don't let any large proteins come in. So they have a zone where they exclude the antiproteases from coming in. They can then release whatever they want to in a very antiprotease-free environment, and that's how they digest. It's an unbelievable paper. It was great. And we call these protective compartments. Very accurate term. Nobody picked up on it. And it wasn't until about 10 years later where a scientist from NYU, he had the same process described the same phenomenon in terms of cell to cell, and he called it an immunological synapse. What a clever term, right? And everybody calls now, even though it has no scientific bearing on what he's looking at, it's called an immunological synapse, and because of that term, that was picked up, and now protected compartments found by the side. So however you name something, it's very important to have the right name, okay? That's a lesson whenever you make a discovery. Okay, so in this case, you have a different type of DNA binding domain, recognizing different types of DNA regions. But again, you're faced with the same outcome where you have a functional domain that actually clips the DNA on both sides, double-stranded clip. Okay? It's a very simple process. Okay, I'm not talking about the Bardi, that's too new. The CRISPR The CRISPR is the same thing, and let me see if I can get this on here, because I thought this was a very good YouTube. All right, let's see. Oh, 1 second. So you see what the difference is. It's the RNA guide that really targets it, and why that's important is because it is a lot easier to design an RNA guide than it is to design these proteins. We know a lot more about making complementary DNA. So that's the advantage and the excitement of CRISPR. Now, it's interesting that these nucleases are used as an immune system, defense system in bacteria for viral infection. They're used to say, oh, this bacteria is a virus or a plasma or something, and it clips it away and reactivates it. So there's a real precedent in biology for this. Now, what are the clinical or potential applications? If you saw one, maybe you can edit the HIV genome in such a way to provide a better vaccine against pathogens. That's a very important application. Another application, maybe we can use this editing system to actually clip the RNA, this HIV virus, in such a way that it becomes inactivated, and use it in infected people. These are long term, okay? Nothing unethical about that so far, right? We can actually cure mice from genetic diseases. What they've done, this is really amazing. They've taken a mouse that has a liver disease, a genetic liver disease, and they've infected it with a virus containing the CRISPR, and it comes in there, and it goes in there and it corrects a small fraction of the hepatocytes. Those liver cells that are mutated, it corrects that, even like 1 in 200, and these hepatocytes multiply, they replicate, and you can actually cure the mice. Even though you haven't transfected all of the hepatocytes, only a fraction, but these mice have been cured, and eventually we'll try this in people as well. Okay, so this is what I just told you, that this gene is distributed in even 1 to 150 hepatocytes, and what? It replicated because of normal, and you killed the mice. Okay. We can use gene editing to fix human embryos. Instead of doing selection, right now we have a process. If somebody has a couple has carriers for Tay-Sachs, for cystic fibrosis, for everything, what do? They don't want to have children like that express these diseases, and these are recessive. So what happens is that you take a couple and you hormonally stimulate the woman, you isolate 20 or 30, you extract 20 or 30 oocytes from the woman, you in vitro fertilization, and you have now 20 pre-implanted embryos, and you do what's called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and you select those embryos that are not carrying, they're not carriers, and they're not, of course, affected. Usually it should be about 25%. You select the best, you implant one or two of those normal embryos back into the woman, and that's how they can have successful, healthy children. And it's a very effective, it's been going on for decades, and it's a very, very effective way of doing this. But this is a selection pattern, right? You're actually selecting what do you do with those embryos which are not going to be used. That presents an ethical challenge. And the question is, can we use genetic aid to fix a human embryo? Take one embryo that has the gene for Tay-Sachs, change the genomics of that, and now reimplant that. So you're not selecting, but you're actually fixing human embryo. And CRISPR, again, they've done this. They've taken a mouse model for cataracts, and they're up to about 33% of these mutant zygotes. They can really fix and inject, and they can these embryos can grow up to be cataract-free mice. So they've proven this principle in mice. Okay? Deficiency is getting slow, but that will improve. Okay. That's one type of genetic editing. Anybody have any questions about that so far? Is that pretty clear? Simple, straightforward. The other type is synthetic biology. And this is, you're reading a lot about this, and as we all know, there are four base pairs that make up the genetic alphabet, and there are two sets, the alanine pairs with valine, cytosine with guanine, and they Together, they code for about 20 amino acids in the genome to make up all the proteins. What we've done recently is, from Scripps Clinic, they created another base pair, an artificial base pair, D5SIC6 and DRNOM, doesn't matter what they are, and they created an organism this is a bacteria, that allowed them to transport the nucleoside and to phosphorylate it to the nucleotide inside the cell, and then inserted these unnatural base pairs into the plasmid, and they are presented to the bacteria, and the E. coli were able to replicate these new base pairs. So now you have an E. coli that, instead of using four base pairs, right, now has a fifth. Now, why would you want to do this?
Is that resulting in the production of the protein?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. That's the next step. Very good. The next step is to make the polymers to get the next protein. But why would you want to do this?
Do they make two more or one more?
I'm sorry?
Do they make two more or one more?
Two. Okay. A base pair. It's a base pair.
Okay.
So why would you want to do something like this?
Isn't that the eventual goal?
To what?
To make new proteins.
And where would you leave it?
I mean, you could use it as a tracer. So, like, if you have one, you have to introduce that microbe E. coli into a population of E. coli. You could use it as a tracer. So
good. Yeah, you probably could. What else?
Species,
or... Oh, that's really nice. Any other ideas? Yeah?
Can you use it to disrupt the other sequences and break things like HIV?
Right. Good. What else? Good. Okay. So classically, to this... reference to your question, they're working on a new paper on this, they'll eventually get that. By the way, what they found is the enzyme that they used to the transporter they got from an algae, it's amazing. This is a transporter that's not specific for nucleosides and take up any of these artificial nucleosides, which is amazing that this algae has this, I don't know why. But anyways, create new types of proteins. Why? To modify pathogens to make better vaccines. We all know that hundreds of diseases, from malaria to dengue fever to Ebola to et cetera, HIV, well, it's very difficult to generate a vaccine. Very difficult. And the idea is you can just modify the DNA or the protein, right? So it's still functional, or not functional really, but can elicit an immune response and cross over. Maybe we can make it better. That's the long-term goal. How this is going to work is a leap of faith, but that's why we're doing this. Okay, so now, ethical semantics in science. When you hear the term gene editing, what does that convey to you? Is that something positive, negative, or neutral? The term gene editing, how does that ring in your spiritual side of your brain or your social side of your brain? Yeah.
I would say it has both. It's not specific enough for me to make a decision, so I want to know. It seems like it presents possibilities that would both be positive and ethical, as well as possibilities that would be...
Make a stand. Positive or negative?
What's that?
Make a stand. Take a stand. Positive or negative?
Positive.
I would say for myself, positive. Outside of maybe
Columbia? Not
radius.
Negative. Interesting. Okay. Anybody else?
I think it's positive, but I also think my students would say you're messing with like natural things and you're editing something that's natural. So it's not a good thing.
I would actually disagree. I think that most people outside of here would think positive, because they would only think of it as the benefits, as opposed to people within this radius to understand the implications where it could have a negative.
Interesting. Anybody else? Again, going back to terminology, how you classify a procedure is very important. Nuclear magnetic resonance was really the basis of what we call MRI, magnetic resonant imaging. Now, why would they change the name? Because they had the word nuclear. What does that convey? Radiation, even though it wasn't. You know, so names do change. Cloning is another example, which no matter how much they've tried to change the name from cloning to some to somatic nuclear transfer, whatever they've changed, it hasn't worked. When you talk about cloning outside of these four walls, there's a negative connotation. And really, science is morally neutral. Science has always been morally neutral. Science makes no statement about its morality. So the question is, gene editing, how will it be? Can we think of better terms? Can you think of a better ethically sensitive term than gene editing? Any ideas?
Gene enhancement.
Gene enhancement. Oh, that sounds good. Anything else? Yeah. Very tactical, okay. Sure. Anybody else?
Something we make us or try to get our students to do, code switching?
Right. Yeah.
Or something like fixing, like gene fixing.
Good.
Or cure.
Gene cure. Well, the problem with gene therapy would be good, right? The problem with gene therapy is you have instances, Gallagher, people who have died because of unethical implementation of clinical trials. So gene therapy has a history of an unethical side to it, and it has a negative connotation. So I'll give you two terms, you tell me if you like them. Genomic microsurgery. Right? It's pretty neutral. Okay? So that's one thing. Or the other one for is genomic engineering. Do you think there are these better terms? You like genomic guys? So do I. Okay. Although people like the second one. Okay, good. So now back to you. What ethical challenges does gene editing present to you? What would you say, what arguments you say we shouldn't be engaged with this technology? Yes.
Well, the example you've already mentioned is that people who died from sort of poor gene therapy experiments, like if it has the potential to hurt people.
Okay, the harmfulness, all right?
Yeah.
Potential harm. Good. What else? Yeah.
Well, in order to find out what's wrong, you would have to basically sequence the entire, well, like look at the person's entire genome.
Okay. Good. And. Privacy. Excellent. Okay? Privacy issues. Right? You don't want, like the famous cartoon where the guy's applying for a job, says you have all the right classifications, all the right qualification experience, however your genome doesn't match what we want. Right? And we're not going to hire you. Employment, right? Okay. Privacy issues. Anything else? Yes? More specific, go ahead.
Like selecting what you want your kids to be like and rejecting all the other possibilities, so then you're just like designing your own children.
Good. Baby designing, right? Yeah. And we're designing and specifically what for non-medical. Non-medical, like nobody would argue. I don't want this kid to be born with Tay Sachs or with cystic fibrosis.
You have to classify what's considered a medical condition.
Great, fantastic, right?
Like but being deaf in the community.
Great example, right? Some people would say that's okay, right? Good.
But the other side of that, if you are arguing from the other side, you would say that we already do that in the traits that we search for in our mates, and even like. study, even the mild, even the population studies that show that people who have recessive genes will have a higher rate of searching for other mates unconsciously. Although you would probably have other arguments, especially in male populations, of searching for other people with those same recessive genes.
I mean, I think last year when I presented, I showed a cartoon. Did I show the cartoon about the twin walking down the street and saying, "Oh, my immune system fell in love with my mate"? Did I show it? What? Did I?
I'm nodding because I think I've heard of that.
So what's the biological basis of that?
The biological basis?
Of that, right.
What do you mean?
The immune system.
Oh, yeah. Evolution, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
No, well, it's very interesting. So it turns out, there's a peanut, pristine Russian Academy. No, besides that, turns out that if you have a couple, there's an area of the genome called MHC, major histocompatibility complex, that is involved in determining what's self proteins, what's foreign. So when a person needs a transplant, the more compatible the MHC region are, the more likely they're going to accept an organ transplant. The more disproportionate the discompatible are, the greater if you have rejection. Okay? And it turns out, they've done a study, that couples that have very close alignment of their MHC genomes are more likely to have affairs and to have a faithless marriage. Whereas a couple that has very diverse MHC are more likely to have a faithful marriage. So that's an immunological basis of marriage. Now, what that raises to all of you is that when you choose a mate, what do you want? A potential organ donor or a faithful marriage? So, but anyways, yes. If
this became
right,
common,
right. But you have to do it en masse. You have to en masse. Okay. What are the bioethical issues? Yeah.
Are there, like, I don't know how specific in terms of which cells are targeted. Like, is this something, are these mutations passable?
Right. If you do it in the whole organism, right, in the germline, you will genetically modify not only your this generation, but future generations. Right. Is that ethical? Yes.
I guess, from what just access and prioritization. So, who gets access to these things?
Fantastic. Great.
Who in the population has access? Who gets treated first? Like, in the case, that should be prioritized
for the approval. Right. Anybody else? Yes.
Also, cost.
Cost. Yeah. Fantastic. Access. Fantastic. See, it's not hard. All right. So all of these, which you've said, follow the four basic guidelines in biomedical ethics, and that is beneficence. What you should do should be doing some good. Should fix your disease, have a positive effect, right? Is athletic enhancement. I mean, we could genetically design using these editing techniques so that a person now has a high EPO in their blood cells. Instead of training at higher altitudes, they're born genetically, they'll be better athletes, theoretically, right? So, are we doing good? Non-maleficence, some are also bad. Are we going to harm, right? Now, I have to tell you this. This is a very important principle, and I'll tell you why. If you look historically, any new technology, whether it's monoclonal antibodies, gene therapy, whatever it is, whenever you go to the first clinical trial where you have volunteers, you always have side effects, and you always have people dying. Does that mean you should don't go that route? We know this. It presents a real ethical dilemma. At what point do you say, we've done enough studies with animals in vitro that we can go to initiate a clinical trial? And yet, if it wasn't for those side effects, the deaths, it would never proceed. We can, it's very rare to predict. And even when we have what we think are good mouse models for diseases, a lot of them fail. We can cure cancer in mice, we have a hard time doing it in humans. We have a lot of mice with neurological models for Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS. When we translate that to the human situation, it's a big leap of faith. So the idea of doing harm can be very difficult. Justice, that's access. Who will have access? This is expensive technology, right? Who will have, how can you contain the costs? Now you should know, costs are a function of time and history. Remember, the first sequencing of the DNA in 2001, were by NIH, right, cost about $1 billion. You know how much it costs today to sequence your DNA?
$1,000.
So in a short 13 years, and within a few more years, it's going to go down. So yes, in the beginning, the cost of these things has the potential of going down, and starting high and going down, but that's not always the case. Look at in vitro fertilization and PGD. The cost has remained pretty much the same. It's somewhere between $20,000 and $50,000 to go through a cycle of in vitro fertilization PGD. The cost has not gone down that much. So a lot depends on the technology that's involved. And then of course, the respect for autonomy. Who has the right to make the decision? Today, right, physicians will tell you, they see the patient, and they say, okay, we have this disease, and this is what I propose to treat, and say, right, no, I just Googled it, this is what I want, right? Who has the right to make really sound decisions on this? In America, autonomy is huge. It says you, as the recipient of this technology, you have that ultimate right to make the decision. Okay? So those are the four principles of bioethics. And as I told you before, science and technology should be now intrinsically morally neutral. Okay, there are other biological challenges. Cloning God. This is more from the religious in America. We've got to take this consideration. A lot of people say, do we have a right to engage in these technologies which are fooling around with such basic biological principles? Right, the high cost, we discussed that. Messing with our genetic integrity, the book of life, right? Do we have a right to do this? Maybe you can say we have a right to change ourselves or to have children healthy, but others, this is, but their children also will have the same now, the normal gene, or the corrected gene, or the modified gene, for generations upon generations. Do we have a right to do this for our children or even our future children? Maybe we only have a right to do it for ourselves. Okay? Can we, synthetic biology, we have what's called dual use, right? There's technology that you know can be used for the good and for the bad. Bioterror weapons are amazing what you can do. And we've read about this over the last few years, but should we be publishing all these new technology, how to change an organism, right? To make it more pathogenic, to make it more transmissible from the animal to the human. We're reading about this all the time. And how do we make sure that this information is not disseminated to organizations that would use this negatively? It's interesting, I've had over the past few years the FBI, the Bioterrorism Group, speak to my class. And it's fascinating what they say. They asked, I think, the two questions that the students asked. One was that we read about all the times that the FBI has curtailed bioterrorist activities or terrorist activities. Is the press underestimating or overestimating the number of times? And both times the FBI said they're underestimating a huge amount. And when you think about, if I were to ask you, if you were designing an ideal bioterrorist weapon, what would you do? If you were designing a biotest weapon, what would you think would be the most effective thing? Yes?
Put it in
the subway. But what type of weapon? What type? What? Give me a name. Anthrax? Anthrax, smallpox, Ebola? Right? What you would think?
Something contagious.
Contagious? Well, it sounds good. No. That's how that was verified. Because in general, we could contain this. Look what happened with, we've had anthrax exposure. We can contain it. And yes, there's the scare factor, the terror factor, which is a very rough, look, the shoe bomber. He wasn't successful. He changed all the security system on every airport around the world by an unsuccessful attempt for terror, right? So there are terror factors considered. But the FBI is worried more about viruses and bacteria that can really destroy the economy. Foot and mouth disease. The only way you can eliminate foot and mouth disease, the most effective, is to kill off all the infected cattle. So if you can disseminate this to the cattle, we'll wipe it out. A virus that affects the corn, the wheat crop, the financial, that'll be a huge problem. And the more concerned about that, which is a lot easier to generate than to set up $1 million lab or the P4 and all the system to create your own bioterrorist weapons. But that's just an aside. And of course, genetic engineering of human in vitro fertilized egg generated embryos. Is that ethical to do? You don't ask your children if you want to be changed. You want to say, listen, like you raised about a deaf couple may want to have a deaf child for a simple reason. We know. We know how to raise a hearing impaired child. We have no idea how to raise a child who can hear. Is that a valid reason, right? And do we have a right? What right do we have to impose our medical perspective onto our children? We do it all the time, but it's still an ethical issue. Now, in applications for non-medical purposes, I told you, increasing EPO levels in athletes, creating stem cells in wrinkled and aged. It works. I can take your mesenchymal stem cells, right? General stem cells, inject them into your face, and guess what? Look at me, no wrinkles. Now, you think, who would do this? Well, do you realize that Americans spend $3 billion a year on anti-aging creams? Now, I'll tell you this, you're not going to hear from anybody else, maybe. Do they work?
No.
Maybe. It's no better than a regular moisturizer. But what are the claims? Listen carefully to what they said. I have a friend who's in this business. It'll say, the ingredients in this product are guaranteed to remove wrinkles, to prevent aging, to remove, you know, dark spots. And that statement is legally and absolutely correct. The ingredients in these products, yes, have the potential, but they didn't put a lot of those ingredients in because they're toxic. So you have a little bit of those ingredients that does nothing, but the statement is true. And we spend $3 billion a year on Dero, Astolati, SK2, whatever. I mean, we all know this, right? And so who wouldn't, you know, remove your wrinkles? It's a lot better than surgery, okay? Promote other gene therapies for non-medical enhancements. Intelligence, looks. They just discovered there's one gene mutation that can convert hair to blonde. Who wouldn't want to have blonde hair? It's easy. Boom. Right? Athleticism, personality traits. There are genes that, if you have those right genes, you're better at risk management, hedge funds, great, right? You're better at non-violence, or the genes that are associated with violence. You have genes that are associated with a whole bunch of behaviors. There are spirituality genes. If you're in the clergy, you want to have a child that's more clerical and spiritual, you want to select for those genes to make the child more spiritual, right? You have all these associations. These are just associations, but is this ethical to apply these technologies for non-medical purposes? And intelligence, right? The same research is going into autism. You've all read New York Times Magazine this Sunday? Did you read it? Oh, you should read the article about autism, about curing autistic kids. But, all these genes that are involved with intelligence or Down syndrome and stuff like that, there's two sides of it, for enhancement and for non-enhancement, right? Why wouldn't you want to enhance the intelligence of your children so that you get to a scholarship at Columbia and don't have to pay for $60,000 a year? Okay, so now, the last thing before I open this up is, who should regulate genomic microsurgery? who would you trust to regulate to make these decisions? So these are the questions I'm leaving you with. So does anybody want to talk about the ethics? Anybody have an impression about how would you resolve this? You have all these ethical issues, you have regulatory issues, we have the technology. Can you think, what is the problem with technology and society? Is part of the genetic makeup of all of us is when we see new technology, we want to develop it. It's very difficult to limit technological development. How many of you are going to get the iWatch? What? But it's there. I mean, look at phones. Look at cellular. You know, my grandkids don't know what a real phone is. What a, you know, a rotary phone. They don't know what a stamp is, right? A stamp. They know what email is. It's texting.
It's funny to think about that side. So I was just thinking, like, you know, GMOs, transgenics, and the FDA. And it seems to me like the FDA sort of ignores the problem and it seems to be more economy driven. The FDA is concerned about any regulation because of, you know, these products are selling. And
the FDA will never, never regulate the skin business, the, you know, anti-aging.
Right.
They won't do that.
Why would that be?
What, you tell me.
I'm just saying economy.
Economy also, it's not toxic. They want to, you know, this is too hot an issue.
Right.
They're never going to do that, right? They're never going to regulate vitamins. I mean, one can go on. Vitamins, in the 70s, that was the hottest thing. Everybody knew if you took your vitamins, you'd be much better, you'd be much healthier. And now we've all these things, it doesn't work. You don't know. Who knows what we don't even know about diet, what food you should take, whatever vitamins. But anyways, but who should regulate this? And how do you resolve these ethical issues?
It would seem like you would need a good number of people of diversity of knowledge and sort of backgrounds and starting points that we need to.
And would it work? We have a presidential commission of bioethics, composed of scientists, ethicists, clergy, psychologists, sociologists. They make recommendations.
And
right? Who would listen to it?
I don't know how effective that
would
be, but
it's better
than the alternative
not having
such a...
Yeah.
So, let's say somebody says, I know it's possible to the doctor, like, I know it's possible to have a child with blonde hair, and the doctor says, yes, it's possible, but I can't offer you that. So, then they can't get it.
Okay, but on the other hand, there's a clinic in New York City that does gender selection. I know the director. So if you want to have a baby boy, you can have it. You want to have a baby girl. But his ethical standards are his own. So he will never allow a couple that has no children to do gender selection. He just says, go someplace else. But if you have 9 girls, you want a boy, he says, sure. If you have 3 boys, you want a girl, sure.
That's what, so he chooses.
He chooses. And he says, if you don't want me, go someplace else. So gender selection, is that medical? Well, there could be instances where gender selection could be medical. Certain accident genes, yes, you would want to have a boy or a girl, you know, depending on the nature. But,
what's this phone
number? No, I'll give it to him. He's a great guy.
I don't have any kids yet.
If you want. I will.
I have 3 girls.
Oh, he'll do it. And depending on how much you want to pay, he can be up to 95% successful.
I'm just going back to, like, the stigma of stem cells, the term, and what the label
right.
is going on to that term. So I think I don't have any faith that it's going to be regulated at all unless a stigma is attached to whatever term it comes with this tech.
Okay. So what do we do?
I'm all for it, so
there's no regulation. Do you think we can really regulate technological development?
I mean, we're Monsanto.
What?
Look at Monsanto.
What, GMO?
Yeah.
What's wrong with GMO?
Well,
I'm asking you.
As in, what's wrong
with
the regulation
Well, what's wrong with genetically modified organism? What's wrong with genetically modified? Give me a danger. Give me a paper that proves that it's dangerous.
Oh, no, no. But as in, the dangers mostly come from the legal ethics where if you have a seed on a Monsanto farm that ends up on another farm, that Monsanto has the legal right to sue that.
That's another issue. But that's legal.
That's within bioethics.
Right.
I mean, the problems are not... That is showing the regulations on the side of the technology, even of the technology.
Even more dramatic example, it was happening in India and in Thailand, where they're going against international patent laws and generating generic HIV drugs because they can't afford it. Africa too. They can't afford it, right? And they say, well, okay, this is, we have to protect our society. Yeah.
That seems to be one of the key issues here. We can expect the market to dictate, you know, say someone wants to choose the gender of the child, this doctor doesn't approve it, there's going to be some other doctor who can. The people will flow to the doctors who will do for them what they want, assuming they have the funds, assuming they have the ability to make that
correct
based on that money. So that seems to me, may end up being sort of the crux of the whole thing in reality. It's like, yes, you can try to dictate the economics of it by placing certain regulations in certain places and guiding the market in one direction or another, but in the end, if these are sort of valuable things to people, the ones who have the money will be able to get at it. But I feel like in many ways that may be the strongest issue in terms of the...
You're saying make it expensive.
No, I'm saying that if these are positive, helpful therapies, then they may only be accessible to certain people and not accessible to other people, and that the sort of possibility of genetic microsurgery and its effects, beneficial or otherwise, may be largely dictated by monetary access to this.
Think of the cosmetic surgery business in South America.
Well, look at the stem cell tourism. Go to China, $25,000, you can do stem cell therapy to cure cancer. Does it work? No more than a placebo effect, right? But they're doing it. What did you want to say?
Just that last comment made me think about the latest, probably insurance regulations that end up to factor regulating this now, because it's only going to be.
And with Obamacare, what are the chances?
and the other thing I'm thinking is that really, if we talk about autonomy, people can't really, as a patient, you can't really make any decisions about these things without some base knowledge of this. And that's another, sort of mental question I have. It's as technology and treatments become more sophisticated, then you require more... expert knowledge.
And more personalized also. Personalized medicine, right?
Can a patient ever really know enough to make an informed decision?
And how important is the experience of a doctor in making the decisions that's not necessarily, based on concrete, biomarkers or diagnostic tests? That's a very good question. Let me ask you a question. You've heard that you know the technology. What stands out to you as the most prominent ethical challenge from these technologies? What?
I can hear you.
What is the most prominent ethical challenge that you see emerging from these new technologies in synthetic biology and genetic microsurgery? What strikes you as the most challenging?
Where does it stop?
The enhancement, the non-medical application. Okay, give me an example.
Where do you draw the line?
So give me an example. Where do you think you're crossing the line?
So,
where do you cross the line?
Me personally, I'm not sure. I have to think more about it. But nobody could argue probably that there's a gradation between a genetic disease that will kill you before you're 2 years old and a genetic disease that you can live a full life.
Like Parkinson's, genetic.
Between sickle cell anemia and malaria.
Great, okay.
But I wasn't thinking of it as in terms of priority, which genetic is worse than the other. I was thinking of it in terms of as this technology develops, and you can change more things,
side and say, oh, we shouldn't change this. Because right now, as far as I understood the beginning of your talk, we're just talking about like replacing like
Oh, correct. So we'll be, I mean, the classical examples, let's say, God forbid, you have a form of hemophilia, right? You can't produce enough hemoglobin. I will take your stem cells, isolate them, grow them up, take your skin cells, convert them to stem cells, grow them up, do genetic engineering in those stem cells, get a really good line that has good target, produce good hemoglobin, do a bone marrow transplant on you, and now you produce normal hemoglobin, you'll be fine. Your children would still be affected, right?
Yeah,
are you going to address your issue about crossing the line?
To address your question, I think that like, the progression of this tech is inevitable.
Right.
And therefore, to me, it all boils down to access.
To what? Access.
Access.
Yeah.
You know, who gets
what? Okay.
Like how much do we have to make?
You know, yes, exactly. It's all about access to it. That's the big
ethical
issue
around
as it is
most. Go ahead. I was going to say, I think what matters to me the most is the inheritance factor. So let's say people might make weird decisions, like, oh, I want to make a child that glows in the dark.
We can do that. Jack the protein. Well, or the issue of racism, if he or she marries a non-glowing person, right? A new level of racism, yeah. You want to say something? Well, you want to say something?
I did, but I don't know how to say it.
So try it. Nobody's going to bite you.
I think the biggest thing for me is just the selfish nature of humans, in that we think, or we kind of operate in the right now, what's going to or even, I think in a broad sense, we like to think that we think about human races as a whole, but we're so limited in being able to do that, that I think that's the part for me that kind of crosses the line.
Okay.
I think, like, science and technology have a long history of introducing things and only finding repercussions of things they've introduced later on. I mean, I think of the X-ray and how, like, you could go to the carnival and get X-rays done. And, like, you were vastly increasing your rate of cancer through a technology that was widely scientifically available and doing these things. But usually, with many of these technologies, immediately seen that this was even with X-rays, it was like, you know.
Well, look at X-rays. Cell phones.
With
cell phones.
Sure.
I mean, there are a lot of studies showing that cell phones in one generate increased risk of tumors. Do you think anybody would put away their cell phone? You know, there's a psychological system now where people sleep with their cell phones, right? And whoever turns off their cell phone, nobody turns off their cell phone. I'll turn off my cell phone. But so most people have the cell phone on 24 hours. I mean, so you have a technology here that may be harmful, we don't know, but there's no way that you're going to stop cell phones.
But it's also when you're doing genomic microsurgery,
mm-hmm.
the amount of time it might take for the repercussions to be known might be so large that it becomes so widespread that you...
Can you think of an example like that? IVF. No LLB, no institutional review board, no FDA would have approved Edwards to have done the first experiment to generate a test tube baby. It worked. He had a cute little baby, you know, Louise Brown. She made Time magazine, and without any LLB approval, and now we have 5 million babies born by IVF. If you would have done it the logical way, you'd apply for an IRB, you have to do a 70-80-year study to look at the effects of in vitro fertilization from birth until death, and then either approve it or don't approve it. But sometimes technology takes such a hold on society, and it can be positive. Can you know?
The biggest problem with crops is
we don't know.
We're only starting to begin some of the repercussions.
We don't know.
Of these crops, and in that time, the genetic diversity of crops, especially corn, has just shrunk so much over the last 50 years because so many are switching to unigene species of crops where like everything is identical.
So, okay, so how do we resolve this? Anybody have any ideas? Don't look at me, I have no ideas. How would you resolve this issue? Yeah.
I'm curious, you probably have more background on this than any of us. What is the current regulatory state? Like, is it just MSF?
Right now, it's just advisory. We have a presidential commission, so this is what, for example, I'll give you a concrete example. We can take stem cells.
Yes.
And they constitute a human liver in a mouse, a human kidney, etc. But nobody has an objection.
Yeah.
What about we constitute a human brain in mice? We can do that. We have mice that have 1-2% of their brains composed of human neurons. Why would any scientist do this? For obvious reasons. They want to understand, is there a difference between the formation of circuits and different cell types in the human system? And this was done by a guy named Irv Weissman, who's a good friend of Sam's. And when he did this about 10 years ago, he went to Stanford IRB, and they said, we can't answer this. So they instituted a panel from the National Academy of Science. They spent 3 or 4 years deliberating this, and they came out with a set of guidelines. They're very logical guidelines, and they said, we'll revisit this every 5 years because we don't know, and they said, don't do this in a whole animal, do it in a vitro because we don't know what the effect is, because if you generate a mouse or chimpanzee with a human brain, if it applies to Columbia, do we have to accept it? And that's a real ethical issue. But these are, so that's what's happening now. Now we have all these commissions set up, all these policies. They have no power.
Okay, so lots of people talking.
Right, lots of people. Which is good. Which is the last slide. Talk about the future of government lobbyists in your upon us. That's very important. That's what we're up to. But how, once you get these guidelines, so I'll tell you one way that may work and may not. It turns out that if the people involved take upon themselves the obligation to regulate the technology, that can work. The classic example is when first did the whole DNA, one of the earliest experiments in 1970 was they wanted to put in a tumor gene into an E. coli. Bill wanted to do this, and a guy from Columbia, Bob Pollock, said, oh, what are you crazy? Everybody has E. coli. Put a tumor gene, everybody's going to get these tumor genes, you can't do it. So they set up a list of our conferences, and the whole group of scientists who are involved in this type of made a commitment that they would never transfect an organism that could live outside the laboratory. They would only do it with organisms that required manipulation, and to only survive in a test tube, in an incubator, in an laboratory, once got out, would die. So in this way, they're regular, and in fact, except for recently, where we just discovered that we've had, where they found smallpox, contamination with CDC, but except for that, in general, we don't know of any case where we've released a genetically modified pathogen that has caused havoc in the world. So self-regulatory by the scientists who are involved can be a good deterrent. It's not perfect. Listen, nuclear energy in the beginning, all of you know that when atomic energy started in the 30s and 40s, the scientists, they had a policy they would never publish the actual methods. They would always have little mistakes because they didn't want it getting out. I mean, today you couldn't do that. If you published a false methodology for what you're doing, you'd get shot, right? But I'm saying that time, but it did it deterred now. Eventually, China, Russia was able to steal secrets. So it's a deterrent. But this, I mean, and we have, even recently, if you remember, in China they used to take criminals, kill them, shoot them, and get their organs, and there was a whole business of organ transplantation. And UN, everybody, protest, nothing worked until the American Kidney Association said to the Chinese government, if you don't stop this, we're not letting any of your fellows do any fellowship abroad, and we're not going to recognize you as legitimate. And that slowed it down, not stopped it. So there are professional ways, I'm sure this is true in teaching too, there are professional ways that you can self-regulate. Yes?
Yeah. Would
he share
with you what gender
is best for most of? Yes. 50-50. 51-49.
I feel better.
So does he. So does he. The only thing he said, which I think is, he's Iranian, by the way. He's from Iran. He used to be, I don't know if he still is, probably the Iranian bioethics committee. He always tells me, when it gets peaceful over there, I'll bring you over, you can talk to them. That'll never happen. But anyways, but aside from that, but the funny thing about this is that he's very religious, and only in Pilarest 2 or 3 years ago would he ever take a gay couple to have a child. Now, so I have no choice. I disagree with it. I'm morally opposed to it, but I don't have a choice. So he's even changing his thinking as well because of social pressure. Yes. Any other questions? Yes.
Surprised or worried me in this discussion. One is, I actually don't have this, probably a lot of people in this room do. How do you make sure that an organization or kind of lab is not going to survive out of that context?
Emphasized as much as I did, is the whole principle of do no harm.
Well, we discussed,
you did discuss do no harm, but we don't, in general, put any therapy into people where we think it might be, might lead to harmful consequences. And so, for instance, male, putting male genes onto chromosomes, there's no way to know what that will do 20 years out, except to do human, that kind of human experimentation. And I don't think anyone's prepared to do that. Is that correct or no?
I have no idea. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. But on the other hand, we have millions of people who go to these clinics because of cancer, and they're taking medicines that don't work for them. Not only work, but help them. So we have, on one hand, I'm excited they should, right? I'm wrong. But on the other hand, people are willing to take risks for a situation that they know how.
Yes, but germline therapy, well, mostly what you talked about is germline therapy is not somatic therapy.
Correct.
And,
but I think we're going past that. I think that we're definitely going to do is that while germline therapy is considered no-no because of the conditions that you face, I think we're trending to make them more comfortable. That's what I'm saying. Good is a bad thing. It is, I would say.
Well, one thing for sure is if you have decent therapies for cancer, then psychotherapies will leave it here. And as you heard from Jed last Monday, and we heard from Tom and Robert, and in fact, we heard from most scientists, that